Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 19th of July, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, and myself, Brian Gerrish.
Well, we're getting straight on with the BBC and Cliff Richard, because obviously the court case, the announcement was made that the BBC had lost their case against Cliff Richard, who was suing them for breach of privacy and so on over the fact that they put a helicopter up with cameras when the police were raiding Cliff's house looking for evidence to support allegations of child abuse or related activity. Of course, there was no there was nothing found in that particular raid, and so Cliff was considered to be not guilty of anything, innocent, but the BBC had put his name all over the papers and their own news coverage, and well, they were found guilty of this, and Cliff was awarded £210,000. On screen at the moment, we've got an interview, or at least an article about an interview with Lord Paton, the former chair of the BBC Trust, who was speaking on Newsnight last night, saying that the BBC would be crazy to appeal against this ruling. He said, and I think it would be crazy for the BBC, arguing that there's some principle of freedom of speech involved, to appeal this decision. Now, of course, it's not about freedom of speech as such, it's about freedom of the press. We're pretty cynical here at the UK Column about what actually occurred here, because, in fact, the standard of journalism that was on display from the BBC, bearing in mind that this is the national media outlet, BBC News, considered to be the top of the profession, and they pull a gag like this, Brian, it's just untenable that this was by accident or through incompetence.
Well, I totally agree. I've always believed that this was an incident that was set up by the BBC in order for the consequences we're now seeing to be created. So why was it in this particular case the BBC seemed to just go mad in their reporting? The police informed them what was going to happen well in advance, and then we're using helicopters to get shots of what's going on here. At the time, it seemed to me that there was something very, very wrong with how the BBC were conducting themselves. Now we see the fallout of those actions, and I think some really serious things have been put in position by the BBC.
Well, let's look and see what serious things, because on the media show on BBC Radio 4 yesterday evening, this lady was one of the guests. That's Susan Aslan, who's a partner at ACK Media Law. And she was asked, is this a significant shift against press freedom? And she said, yes, she thinks it is. It represents a flow. There is a direction of travel generally judicially in this direction. There were no decider cases on the issue of investigations being an invasion of privacy. And if you can't report on the police investigating or searching someone's house, that is quite a landmark change. She was asked, does that mean that suspects in a police investigation cannot be named before being charged? And she said, yes, it does, unless there is, for example, a risk to public safety. For example, if a murderer is on the loose, then the press can say who they are, who the public is to look out for. Also, the next person who was interviewed on that programme was the editor of the Yorkshire Post. And just coming back to this point about whether this was a deliberate action by the BBC or incompetence, he said quite clearly, he was quite unequivocal about it, none of his journalists would be so incompetent as to have reported on this in the way that the BBC did. He was almost incredulous about how the BBC had reported this. I don't think he could quite believe it either. And this is an editor of, not just the Yorkshire Post, but he's actually heads up quite a number of the Johnson Press titles. There's no question in my mind, and you've said the same, that this was a setup.
A set piece action in order to create follow-on events, and those follow-on events have happened, and we can now see the real danger that we're going to get in the position where the police can lift people. They disappear from their homes, from their cars. You're not even allowed to talk about it. And if we can give you one classic case to emphasise the danger of this, Melanie Shaw effectively disappeared from a home, from the streets, from communication with others. And it was only by actually speaking out about her and contacting the police themselves and saying, we're about to report a missing person, that Nottingham Police agreed to admit that they actually held her in custody. So if we hadn't have put out the news reports, we hadn't have followed it up by questioning the police themselves, Melanie Shaw would have simply disappeared from her home and possibly disappeared into a Gulag prison and psychiatric system in UK. Nobody would be the wiser. She would have simply disappeared. And here we have the BBC, which of course has over the years conducted itself in a way which has protected people abusing children, has now facilitated possibly even that area, that you, if you have somebody who is on a suspect list of abuse, now you really can't go near them as a result of the BBC's actions. I think this is very, very dangerous stuff. Meanwhile, the BBC is bigging up on things like this. Now, I'm going to thank the person who sent this through to me. I looked at it, I read it, I reread it, and then I thought, what exactly is the BBC doing here? But we'll see how you react as our audience today. So BBC News, the headline is Generation Sensible in Five Charts. And for once, they actually meant what they said in the headlines, because this is the only comment. It says, rebellions of young people have been recorded for decades, bucking trends and breaking the rules before entering the world of being a boring grown-up. But a new generation is coming through and truly shocking society. How? By becoming more sensible. For example, a survey conducted by the British Pregnancy Advisory Service showed teenagers are becoming less likely to have sex, preferring to spend time with their families and having romantic relationships online. These graphs show how under 25s are shunning vices that have been perhaps unfairly associated with their age group. So that is the only comment that the BBC makes. And then this is the information that they're crowing about. We just bring this up on screen. So we've got goodbye booze. Young people are drinking less. And we've got a very slight downward trend there. We've got just say no. Youth drug use is dropping. English and Welsh 16 to 24 year olds who have taken drugs, and the percentage has dropped from a high of about 55% back in 1996 or so to roughly 38% in 2016. I'm guesstimating off these images to make that report. Think before you do it. There are fewer teen pregnancies now. And that's showing quite a drop.
But what they haven't done is perhaps look at whether that's a result of behaviour or the fact that there's less likelihood to be getting pregnant these days.
Well, these are the key questions, Mike, and the questions that came into my mind. Let's do the last one. We've got another one as well. Stub it out. Young people are less likely to smoke. And we've got this one. Fewer young people are getting arrested, where we see apparently a massive drop. From 2007, where we had about 350,000 young people, 10 to 17 being arrested, and now that's dropped to under 100,000 in 2017. Now, these are statistics which have come out apparently of the Ministry of Justice and Youth Justice. So we're not questioning the actual veracity of the statistics themselves, but I think you're on the button, Mike, here, because this is where my brain took me. There's no analysis as to the background of what's going on here with any of the statistics. So the arrests, are these young people now too frightened of the state to challenge it? Have we got young people living in fear of being arrested? And if they're arrested, the press isn't even going to report it, for example. Is more time having romantic relationships online really a good thing?
Well, surely face-to-face contact is much better.
One would have thought if you're having a romantic relationship, you might want to meet the person, but not according to the BBC. Are the lower levels of drugs actually safe drugs? Are there fewer drugs being taken, but are they more dangerous drugs? Was a question which occurred to me. Does the purported drop in these acclaimed areas signify the result of government behavioural insights experiment? So are these genuine drops, or are these drops as the result of government campaigns? And whilst we could say, well, these could be good areas for the government to campaign in, we say the use of applied behavioural psychology when people are not aware they're being targeted is highly dangerous. And of course, for every good campaign the government runs, have we now got campaigns to get us used to constant war as being a good thing? BBC, of course, doesn't discuss any of these things. Are these youngsters also shedding traditional families in a move to heteronormativity, transgender and transhumanism? So a whole raft of questions. And Mike, I think we can say once again, what is the BBC up to? I think this is propaganda. I think it's trying to take the eye off things. Meanwhile, we've got the really dangerous stuff with press freedoms, police arrests, and the BBC's actions around Cliff Richard.
Well, another day, another item in the Novichok 2, the sequel saga. Here are the scribbles on screen, of course, because apparently the police believe that several Russians were involved in the attempted murders of the Skripals and the other two Amesbury victims. Well, let's have a look at some of the mainstream media headlines. Here we go. BBC, Salisbury poisoning. Police identify Novichok suspects. We've got Sky News, suspected perpetrators of Skripal Novichok attack identified. We've got The Guardian, Novichok poisoning. Police identify Skripal suspects, reports. Reports with an S, okay. We've got France 24 here, just for a bit of variety, just to show it's not just the UK media.
Well, they did win the World Cup, Mike, well, so it's only fair.
Okay. UK police identified Novichok suspects as Russians, report. So in this case, it's a report. Well, that's slightly more accurate. So let's just see, because there's one common feature to every single one of these reports. And here it is. This is the text. Investigators believe that they have identified the suspected perpetrators of the Novichok attack through CCTV and have cross-checked this with records of people who entered the country around that time, a source with knowledge of the investigation told the Press Association. They, the investigators, are sure they, the suspects, are Russian. So let's just look at this a little more closely. Investigators believe suspected perpetrators, a source, unnamed, with knowledge of the investigation. Well, I have knowledge of the investigation. Well, they don't say what degree of knowledge of the investigation. It's just a source. Is this somebody they met on the street? Of course, they're sure that they were Russians.
Well, they had to be Russians, because otherwise it doesn't fit the government agenda. You don't need evidence.
No,
it was the Russians.
No, lots of people are sure. Now, why am I highlighting this piece of text? Because this piece of text is common to every one of those mainstream media reports. And all that the mainstream media have done, the BBC and The Guardian and so on, is put some text around this particular quote. This is the entirety of it. This is the basis of the whole thing. We're talking about press freedom today. Sometimes I have to say, Brian, I don't think Britain deserves to have a press if this is its standard.
Well, this is getting worse, of course, Mike, because this material is now being pushed around increasingly via the internet, as you've pointed out. And if people look locally, you will see that their local papers, your local papers, have virtually disappeared. There's one or two tiny newspapers dotted around the country. The rest of them are all hoovered up in these conglomerates that are sharing these stories, and then they're printed as if they came from a separate news source. So it's another form of deception on the general public, I think.
Yeah, I'll just highlight a tweet that Craig Murray put out this morning. He said, unnamed source close to unnamed British police officers tells unnamed Press Association journalist, Britain knows the unnamed Russian agents who attacked the Skripals, doorknob with gel-filled perfume bottle, then went to central Salisbury to leave it in a park, totally convinced. I think I've got to agree with the sentiment expressed there. But anyway, let's move on. This morning, the Brexit team, here they are. These are the four key people in the Department for Exiting the European Union. We're giving answers to questions in the House of Commons. I'm not even going to bother talking about that because it isn't worth talking about. But I just wanted to make the point here. Who have we got? On the left, we've got Chris Heaton-Harris, MP, who's Parliamentary Under Secretary of State. Then next to him, is Dominic Raab MP, who's the Secretary of State for exiting the European Union. Then beside him, we've got Robert Walker MP, who's another Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State. And then on the right, we've got Suala Braverman MP, who's another Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State. And I just thought to myself, Brian, this is the, what is this, the most important negotiation that Britain is involved in our generation. And this is the four that we have in charge of it. What experience do they have in running a negotiation of this scale? And, you know, what qualifies them to do this job?
Probably they haven't got a lot of experience or skills. Therefore, the chaos, they can be relied on to help develop the chaos. It will just come in naturally. It will look realistic.
Well, I'll take that point. But I was thinking to myself, if this is the four, if these are the four front people, who's behind them? Well, in fact, it's this man, Philip Ryecroft. He was appointed permanent secretary to the Department for Exiting the European Union in October 2017. Of course, a civil service man, supposedly politically neutral, supposedly there to support the four stooges you've just seen on screen. As permanent secretary, he will have responsibility for supporting the document, the department in the negotiations to leave the EU and establishing the future relationship between the EU and the UK. Now, he was appointed second permanent secretary to the head of the UK governance group in the Cabinet Office in June 2015. So here we've got a Cabinet Office man who's right in the centre of the Department for Exiting the European Union. Watch yesterday's programme if you want to get a bit more context on what that might mean. And he has, in that role, which is a secondary role, he has responsibility for constitutional and devolution issues in the UK. So we have the man who is there to support us leaving the European Union is also second permanent secretary in the UK governance group. Now, the UK governance group was established in June 2015 to head the UK government's work on constitutional and devolution issues. It brings together under one command the Cabinet Office Constitution Group, the Scotland Office, the Office of the Advocate General for Scotland and the Wales Office. The group will ensure that the civil service has an improved capability to support ministers in the vital challenge of sustaining the United Kingdom and the constitutional settlement. So this man is right at the heart of breaking up the UK into regions, which of course is right at the heart of EU policy. We go on from 2012 to 2015. He was Director General at the Deputy Prime Minister's office. The Deputy Prime Minister at that time was Nick Clegg, an EU man, a Remainer, one of Leon Britton's boys, if I remember rightly, supporting the Deputy Prime Minister across the full range of his policy interests. His policy interests at that time were devolution and breaking up the UK into European-style regions. And prior to that, he was Corporate Affairs Director. This man, Philip Ryecroft, was Corporate Affairs Director at Hutchison Whampoa Europe Limited. Now, Hutchison Whampoa, of course, roots in Hong Kong in the 1800s, right at the heart of the Opium Wars, absolute British Empire establishment company, which made its billions from the Opium Wars to date, but they were really kicked off as a business at that time. So this is the man that we have supporting those four illustrious campaigners going to the European Union tomorrow for more negotiations with Monsieur Barnier, and this is the kind of person, the man who is breaking up this country at the Constitution Unit of the Cabinet Office.
A Cabinet Office, of course, with the assistance of that Pearl Office. We're going to continue to talk about this office. This is the hidden office inside the Cabinet Office system that is dealing with the big corporate and banking interests. We are working very hard on getting more information about this system, but we are now starting to get some very interesting reports from people who appear to know what they're talking about. So we'll keep you posted on that. Well, if you're carrying out a sort of devious program on the general public, you need help from the mainstream media. So let's bring in the Times. And here we are. This is an article by political editor Francis Elliott. Tory turmoil could lead to a far-right revival. Leave voters' sense of betrayal over Brexit and fear of immigration create the perfect conditions for a new protest party. Our views on race, immigration and Brexit are full of contradictions, but taken together, this jumble of prejudices and ideas is about to shape the, is about to change the shape of British politics. And he goes on to say the return to dominance of the two main parties, which saw Labour and the Conservatives share around 80% of the vote, was one of the most surprising consequences of the referendum 2 years ago. It left many in the centre ground pining for a new party, but it now seems likely that it's on the right rather than the middle ground that a new force will appear. And I just put in a question here. Is this a prediction, or a subliminal message that the new right-wing party is already being created? I find this article absolutely fascinating in how this man spins material together, it seems to me, to help create that right-wing party. So let's have a look at what he said. This is Francis Elliott in the flesh, as it were. He says, at first sight, immigration doesn't appear to be a factor in the discontent felt by voters. The number of Britons identifying immigration as the most important issue has declined steeply since 2016, while the number identifying Brexit has risen on a similarly striking gradient. But taken together, concern about immigration and the delivery of Brexit mark those who feel disenfranchised by the Westminster establishment and explain the outrage felt by some voters towards Mrs. May's Chequers plan. So this is subtle stuff. He takes two things. He takes immigration. He takes the Brexit vote. He says the immigration one drops, but unhappiness about Brexit increases. And then he mixes them together back into Brexit. So immigration, he makes part of the Brexit equation, even though he says that immigration as an issue has declined steeply since 2016. This is amazingly crafted wording by this man. So let's go on through. He says it's an uncomfortable truth that just over a quarter of respondents in a recent British Social Attitude survey said they were very or a little prejudiced towards people of other races. So we now get in a survey. We don't get the details of that survey. But the fact that some people said we are a bit prejudiced towards other people, this now becomes a key point which he's going to use. Now, this isn't some young journalist who's getting a bit mixed up here. This is a man I would suggest would consider every word, every sentence that he puts together. And so it goes on. In comes Robinson, Tommy Robinson. But Robinson's anti-migrant creed has no shortage of high-profile supporters. Here is Donald Trump speaking alongside Theresa May after their Chequers summit last week on the damage the president believes migration is doing to the cultural fabric of Europe. I just think it's changing the culture. I think it's a very negative thing for Europe. I think it's very negative, he said. So we've gone from people, 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit. We've now brought in racial prejudice. We then can bring in Tommy Robinson, and then we can also hang it apparently on Trump. And just to get the point home, we often have shown this slide, but this is a gentleman now deceased, Peter Sutherland, who, as a very powerful man in politics, said, well, we need the mass migration in order to break down nation states to assist the European Union project. So effectively, according to the Times, we can't debate what Mr. Sutherland says, because if we do, we're all racists. Yeah. This is the message that the Times is putting across. And so let's go on. He says, where are we? Sam Brownback, the US Ambassador for International Religious Freedom, is reported to have warned Sir Kim Darroch, Britain's ambassador in Washington, that if Britain did not treat Tommy Robinson more sympathetically, the Trump administration might be compelled to criticise Britain's handling of the case. And then Elliot goes on, Mr. Trump's son, Donald Jr., has tweeted support for Robinson. A US think tank, Middle East Forum, helped to organise a rally in support of him in London and sent a Republic congressman, Paul Gosar, to speak in his support. So this is quite amazing, Mike, because this top journalist with the Times simply links the Middle East Forum in and pins it on Donald Trump. But of course, what they don't want to say is what this organisation really is. So my comment is either with woeful lack of professional investigation as to the facts, or to deliberately deceive his readers, Elliot does not declare that the Middle East Forum, backing Tommy Robinson, is an extremist pro-Zionist, pro-Israel organisation dedicated to an ultimate Israeli victory over the Palestinians and others who challenge the Israeli state. This man, we're led to believe, is not bright enough to have discovered that for himself. I don't believe that at all. So if we do a bit of analysis here, I think these are the key points to run through. If we dare to talk about immigration or Brexit, we're confused, jumbled is what he's saying, and prejudiced. A jumbled confusion will reshape politics, i.e. create a new dangerous right. So if you believe in Brexit, you're a racist and you're helping to create a new dangerous right. So those 17.4 million who voted Brexit are all racists, prejudiced to a people of other races. If you are for Brexit, you're pro Tommy Robinson and Trump. Apologies for the little bit of additional text there. Trump is pro Tommy Robinson, and therefore it's also implied that Trump's a racist as well. And we've got that our confusion and prejudice on Brexit and race is a fertile ground for what he calls xenophobic insurgents. So if you voted for Brexit, you are going to create this far right, which is extremist and racist, and it's going to be comprised of xenophobic insurgents. I found this pretty dangerous article, Mike, and I think the aim is to actually say that party is being created, and we'll have a look at perhaps how that's going to be done after the advert.
Okay, so tonight, Ian Crane is in the studio. Just one programme tonight. He's doing Fracking Nightmare at 7.30, not the usual 9 p.m. And what's he covering? Well, he's covering Quadrilla Injunction, of course, that he's involved in, the lack of emergency response planning, water shortages in the northwest of England, because, of course, it's going to be very difficult for Greg Clark to sign off on the Quadrilla frack in Lancashire when they're about to impose a hosepipe ban. But another thing that's of quite interest is this, because they'll be talking about this, another earthquake in Surrey Swarm near Newdigate. A swarm of what they're describing as a swarm of earthquakes that have taken place, nine seismic events above 1.5 on the Richter scale since the 1st of April, another two yesterday. And the fracking companies claiming that it's nothing to do with them, but Ian making the point that the epicentres of these events are within a two-mile radius of both the Brockham and the Horse Hill frack sites. So he'll be talking about that and giving the full details of that later on.
Okay.
7.30, ukcolumn.org/live.
Okay, thank you for that, Mike. Right, let's come on to Tommy Robinson demonstrations, just keeping in mind the report we've just taken you through by the Times, by Mr. Elliott. So let's remind ourselves of the demonstrations. Quite a lot of people on the streets on the 14th of July, not as many as in the previous demonstration. But what sort of thing was taking place? Well, we found it pretty remarkable. Here we've got a gentleman called Abby and his mum on stage. Apparently they're Australian Tommy Robinson supporters. And what are we interested in? Well, we're very interested in what this man said. He said this, and together with his mother, but the main comment we're coming to is his. We love Tommy Robinson in Australia, and we know this. We're coming together, and there are millions and millions in Australia that support Tommy, that support you, and are here to support you, and are here to fight the fight together, united, no matter what the left call us. I am the world's proudest Jewish Nazi, and Tommy is my brother, and is my friend, is my leader. So here we've got a gentleman on stage, showing on screen. I'm pretty sure he's wearing a skull cap, and he's boasting to the audience that he is a Jewish Nazi. Now, that's a very interesting concept, which we could have a little bit of a discussion about. But I'm going to say I don't get a warm feeling for what sort of man this individual is. But let us also remember that the Middle East Forum that has set up these demonstrations is also vehemently pro-Zionist, pro-Israel, and they have said that Israel needs an overwhelming victory to crush any of the people that are challenging Israeli politics in the region, effectively. Mum came to the fore as well. She very quickly said the whole problem with what's going on at the moment is Islam. It's Islam. We didn't get a lot of background into Abby's mum, only that she travelled thousands of miles to come on this stage and tell a British audience that they didn't really understand their own problems. But for her, it was Islam. So some questions to be asked. Then it gets very interesting because, of course, this man took the stage, which is Gerard Batten, the UKIP leader. And I found it extraordinary that he would take to the stage after somebody had boasted that they were a Jewish Nazi. But clearly he was happy to do that. And this is a screenshot of him starting his speech. And let's paraphrase what he had to say to keep it as short as we can. He said, well, yes, Tommy Robinson is a criminal, but many other criminals have become heroes. The suffragettes, Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, he was involved in conspiracy to murder, but he's now a hero. And now, just like Robin Hood, Tommy Robinson is protecting the weak and the vulnerable. The real problem is that the rape gangs are all of the cult of Muhammad. Tommy has been brave enough to speak out. He then talks about this problem in greater detail. Join UKIP. So Gerard Batten, the leader of UKIP, which many people would say, many people might disagree with UKIP policies, but it was known as a well-behaved party of decent supporters. And I'm happy to stick with this. There were problems amongst the leadership itself, but certainly it was not known as an extremist right-wing party. But here's Gerard Batten now on stage, jumping right into the middle of it. So what I found so disturbing about this man's talk is that basically he's failing to talk about the child abuse riddled political and social establishment that has abused children and encouraged and protected a vast array of child abusers and abused gangs over a great many years. He fails to speak about the child abuse whistleblowers now being held in prison for trying to expose the British state child abuse system. And he can only focus on the Asian gangs, one part of the abuse system. So if you analyse what this man is doing, his agenda protects the controlling establishment child abusers who are allowing the Asian rape gangs to perform in exactly the same way they're allowing the rape gangs, be they political, establishment, white, so-called Christian or wherever. And as John Wedger, the former Metropolitan Police officer, said, wherever you have a gang in control, it might be a Somali gang, it could be an Italian gang, it could be a range of other different nationalities. In any city that you have one of these gangs in control, they will be the people controlling prostitution, the sex trafficking and the abuse of children. So Gerard Batten absolutely moving to the extreme right. He is following a speaker who claims that he is a Jewish Nazi. This seems to me to be helping to create this extreme right wing party, Mike. I might have this wrong. So let's remind ourselves the background to that Middle East Forum. Encourage people to go and see it, read it for yourself. But here they are boasting that they organised 25,000 strong protest in support of Tommy Robinson. They're planning additional rallies. That was the 14th of July rally. And they're putting up the money to defend this man in court. And we highlighted the fact that basically they were pushing this Israel victory project, which many people would find deeply disturbing. So no reports on the Israeli backing for the Middle East Forum in the BBC. There's no backing or exposure of it in the Times article by Mr. Elliott. What we've simply got is a wall of silence here as this extremist pro-Zionist organisation backs these demonstrations. Now, to ensure that we're accurate in our reporting, I'd also like to just show you this screenshot, which I think is highly significant. There were an appreciable number of black and non-white people within the crowd at this demonstration. They were obviously mixing freely without any problem at all. This gentleman was at the front of the barrier close to the stage. The cameraman said to him, "Are these people racist?" And he laughed and said, "Not at all. We're all here to support Tommy Robinson and Trump." And as he said that, the white man to his left reached forward and patted him on his shoulder. So none of this, of course, was reported by the BBC or reported in the Times. But I get a sense of unease here, Mike, that I think we can see people being highly manipulated in order to form this extreme right-wing party, which, of course, can unleash the violence and then unleash the state clampdown. And now we're getting to the stage where the press won't even be able to report the arrests, thanks to the efforts of the BBC.
OK, here we are, arch hypocrite and Minister of War, Gavin Williamson here. Has launched a new medal for sailors, soldiers and airmen who've taken part in Iraq or Syria. It's the Operational Service Medal Iraq and Syria, which is also known as the Operation Shader Medal. This is the first Operational Service Medal to be created since 2003 and has apparently its own distinct ribbon and clasp. So that's really fantastic. Gavin Williamson said the campaign against Daesh is one that our armed forces can be extremely proud of. Eliminating the threat from terrorism is critical to our security at home and abroad. Oh, really, Gavin? Well, let's have a look at how much your... well, let's just have a look at the...
We're lost for words.
Yes. Here is the latest report on the Conflict Stability and Security Fund, which came out late yesterday evening, the annual report 2017-2018. It says that, it says this. During 2017-2018, the Conflict Security and Stability Fund provided over £11 million to support the Syrian Civil Defence, also known as the White Helmets, in Syria. The UK is their biggest contributor and provides the funds to support over 4,000 volunteers and 140 teams throughout Syria who provide life-saving services to civilians. No, they don't. The project, this report says, is estimated to have saved over 115,000 lives. No, it hasn't. And we'll have much more to say on this 115,000 lives in the not-too-distant future. Can't just say anything more about that at the moment. That's not the point. The point is here, they're admitting to putting £11 million and a whole host more money into a group of people that I think we've demonstrated over the last couple of years are... at the very least, you can say, is directly linked to the terrorists that Gavin Williamson is giving out medals to armed services personnel for allegedly dealing with. What is the Conflict Stability and Security Fund? Well, I'm going to say it's about securing and stabilising conflict around the world. This represents the policy of perpetual low-intensity warfare and it provides a market, of course, for the military-industrial complex. But let's have a look at the areas that the money is going into. And it's not a coincidence that these areas in dark blue on screen are the areas where there is conflict. And so this is all about stabilising that conflict, I believe, and making sure that the money is put in the right places to make sure that conflict runs along quite nicely without getting too much out of hand, reducing by any significant amount either.
So we can hoover up the assets, presumably.
Well, we can hoover up the assets. It provides a market for military production. But it's also, of course, about driving migration, because this creates a whole other market in people trafficking that creates pots of money for people. And, of course, Britain benefiting from £130 billion profit from this market each year and putting almost nothing into so-called law enforcement. So let's go back to the CSSF report. And of course, one of the things that I've been trying to do over the last several months is to get hold of specific details about the funding for the White Helmets. And what became clear is that the White Helmets provide a quarterly financial statement to the Ministry of the Foreign Office, that information gives a breakdown of where the money that is that's been given to them is spent. Now, the Foreign Office refuses to release that information. So there's a section on that issue in the annual report, and it says this: due to the highly sensitive nature of some of the CSSF's work, it is not possible to publish details of all programme spend. The two key reasons why it would not be possible to make programme documentation public are to protect national security and to protect the safety and security of the beneficiaries, partners and partner governments. Regional and thematic boards take the decision on what can be published and apply similar criteria to that set out in the Freedom of Information legislation. So what is this? An admission that money is going into projects that perhaps the government might be embarrassed about? That seems to me to be what it is. So that's the issue of transparency. Here's another area that CSSF money is going into, and that is the Pakistan Consolidating Democracy Programme. And here we have a spend of £6.65 million going into Pakistan. 53% of that money is being spent on what they describe as consolidating democracy. 47% is going into strengthening electoral and legislative processes through support to UNDP. Sorry, strengthening electoral processes. Right. Is that not interfering in elections? I think it is. I think that is interfering in elections. So here we have the Conflict and Stability and Security Fund being used to interfere in elections. Just to give a little bit of the text, this program aims to support Pakistan in developing a democratic system in which government institutions are capable, parliaments are accountable, and the state as a whole is responsive to the needs and aspirations of the public. It has an enhanced focus on improving women's political participation. And here's the key point, Brian. Program activities mapped women who were not registered to vote and engaged them through civic outreach, workshops, street theatre in remote areas, social media and radio. So this is exactly money going into the types of programmes that BBC Media Action, Thomson Reuters Foundation promote.
This is British soft power, and what's being used here is applied psychology. So this is all British government behavioural insights getting into the heads of people to make them think that they need the corrupt form of democracy, which we've already got in Britain. It is so callous and so cynical, this business, it's almost breathtaking.
So when you read the term Conflict Stability and Security Fund, I think it's best to move the comma, perhaps, and that might explain what it's all about.
So, okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's the end of today's news. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll say a very big thank you to all of the people who attended the George meeting for the UK column and the British Constitution Group last night. It was wonderful to see so many people, and it was absolutely fascinating to hear the stories and reports that are now coming in on a number of issues in the country. So we had a gentleman who travelled all the way from Cardiff to talk about fraud and corruption and bullying in the police, cover up by local authorities, actions within social services. We've got people talking about campaigns now to stop 5G coming into position. And altogether, it was a very friendly, very uplifting meeting. So thank you for those who came. And a big thank you to those who've given us some generous donations there at the same time. That's it for today. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.